Conspiranormal, guys. It's your host, Adam Sane. And we got Luke over here. Oh, wait. Luke's not here. I don't see Luke.
It's invisible.
There's Luke nothing. Today. There's no... Here, everybody. Just for everybody to feel like Luke is here. There's some page turning there for you. We got... but we do have Mr. Rob Lenz over here producing. The maestro, as I like to call him.
The one-handed producer
tonight. Yeah, the one-handed producer. Guys, we have, coming on tonight, we have Mr. Scott Bennett, who is a whistleblower. And he's written a book called Shell Game, The Betrayal and Cover-Up by the U.S. Government of the Union Bank of Switzerland, Terrorist Threat, Finance Connection to Edward Snowden's Leaks About Booz Allen Hamilton and U.S. Central Command. So this should be a rather interesting show. We're going to kind of like dig deep into some skullduggery and to some intrigue tonight. It's very kind of cool to have someone that's an actual, you know, a whistleblower that's trying to go into and go resolve with... I'm losing my mind.
Bringing stuff to light.
Thank you. A little tired today, so apologize for that. You know, Luke's not here to keep me, like, you know, to keep the energy level up and everything. But, guys, we're going to be talking about that to him in just in a few minutes. But I wanted to read an article. We'd like to talk about some weird stuff on the show. And what we're going to talk about is The Walking Sam. Have you ever heard of this? Rob,
I've heard the name. I'm trying to think of what it was. It's sort of one of those creepy spirity types.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Slender Man kind of creature. But let's kind of like dig into this. And I heard this on Micah Hank's show on the Grayland Report, and I'd never heard of it. But he's, like I said, he's kind of similar to Slender Man. He's kind of similar to some other creatures like the Mad Gasser and stuff like that. We'll probably get into that like later on. There's some real cool stuff. But this is from dailydot.com, and this is an urban legend encouraging South Dakota Sioux teams to take their own lives. The Boogeyman, Tall Man, the Gentleman, the Babadook, Slender Man, and now Walking Sam. He has haunted us in various fictional forms for centuries, but now the spectral figure of traditional folklore and modern urban legends may be having a very real impact on teens' lives. An increasing number of suicides are occurring on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and they're being attributed to Walking Sam. Since December, a staggering 103 suicide attempts have occurred on the reservation home to the Ogallala Lakota subtribe of Sioux Native Americans. Out of these attempts, 9 people between the ages of 12 and 24 have died. One witness account alleges that the number of attempted suicides was as high as 241 over a 3-month period. Ogallala Sioux Tribe Vice President Thomas Poorbear told the Associated Press that he recently discovered a slew of recent Facebook posts of an ominous display of nooses hanging from trees. In February, Poorbear said, A parent came to him with an alarming Facebook post. Nooses hanging in trees near Porcupine, a community of about 1,000 people. Tribal police later took down 4 nooses, apparently left there as an invitation, but could not determine who was responsible. The New York Times elaborated on this incident, noting that local pastor John Two Bulls was tipped off to a group suicide planned in a wooded area outside the town of Pine Ridge. Would you love to have the name like Poor Bear and Two Bulls? That'd be pretty cool. After racing to the location, he and other adults found and removed the nooses and counseled teenagers who had assembled at the spot before anyone could make an attempt. The Associated Press also reported that teachers recently foiled a plan by several high school girls to take their lives simultaneously. Multiple reports on the rash of suicide attempts have cited folkloric elements as contributing factors in these incidents. One reservation minister, Chris Carey, described the presence of a tall man spirit to the Times, who is appearing to these kids and telling them to kill themselves. Ogallala Sioux Tribe President John Yellowbird Steele, another cool name, stated that many Sioux believe in entities like a suicide spirit similar to the Slender Man. Another minister, Reverend Ron Hutchcraft, who is based out of Arkansas, described the phenomenon to the Mission Network News as the shadow people or the dark people. There are spirit beings, demonic beings, that are stalking the reservation and convincing young people that they are worth nothing, and that have started this cloud of death over this reservation. Walking Sam isn't a new phenomenon. Last year, Redditor u/rimbim9 posted to the subreddit, r/icandrawthat, requesting an image of what they described as Walking Sam, a Slender Man counterpart who loomed over their stay at Pine Ridge. On my latest trip to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, I kept hearing stories of this man who would roam the streets at night. Some locals claim to see him, but I cannot find anything anywhere on this man. Here are some of the details on this guy. Kind of scary. People believe he is sent on this earth as punishment and is just looking for company. u/rimbim9 also listed many of Walking Sam's purported physical attributes. According to his description, the specter is 7 feet tall, has a lean figure, has no mouth, and carries the bodies of Lakota men and women off his arms. Weird, I know. People believe he is sent on this earth as punishment and is just looking for company, he wrote. Of course, the descriptions of Walking Sam are rooted in centuries-old mythology and folklore. The ring of nooses in the forest, for instance, harken back to the scenes from found footage films like The Blair Witch Project, while the anonymous encouragement to follow through on the attempts bears an eerie inverse resemblance to Japan's notorious suicide forest. Aokigahara, which is littered with signs and messages begging those who go there not to complete the attempt. The shadow people are also part of a long-standing urban legend. The most obvious source for the tall man is the boogeyman, who is often described as a spectral, lanky figure in black who steals bad children away. The boogeyman has found a popular recent revitalization in Slender Man, a creature so compelling that last year several teens committed assault, reportedly due to the influence of the Slender Man mythos. When Slender Man, or Slendy, was created in 2008, his popularity immediately gave rise to a number of spin-off mythical figures, including the fabricated legend of the German Der Grossmann and variations of the Fall of the Tall Man, who was first introduced in 1979's Phantasm. But long before any of this, the people of the Dakota and Lakota have exchanged stories about Walking Sam. In these tales, he goes by multiple names, including Stovepipe Hat Bigfoot and simply Big Man. Here's an account of him by Ogallala Lakota medicine man Pete Catches, taken from Peter Matheson's 1983 book about Pine Ridge and the spirit of Crazy Horse. There is your big man standing there, ever waiting, ever present, like the coming of a new day. He is both spirit and real being, but he can also glide through the forest like a moose with big antlers, as though the trees weren't there. I know him as my brother. I want him to touch me, just a touch, a blessing, something I could bring home to my sons and grandchildren, that I was there, and I approached him, and he touched me. It's weird. Many in the community have linked reported appearances of Walking Sam to teens taking their own lives. In 2009, Walking Sam was alleged to have been spotted in the Pine Ridge community, which coincided with an occurrence of multiple teenage suicides. Blogger Mike Crowley described attending a meeting of the Tribal Council at the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, where a tribeswoman asked government officials for help dealing with Walking Sam. One local woman, this is a guy from his testimony, who left before I could talk with her personally, asked Washington for help dealing with Walking Sam. The woman, who was elderly but otherwise quite lucid, described Walking Sam as a big man in a tall hat who has appeared around the reservation and caused young people to commit suicides. She said that Walking Sam has been picked up on the police scanners, but that the police have not been able to protect the community from him. She described him as a bad spirit. She wanted help from Washington with foot patrols for the tribal communities to protect them from Walking Sam. Later, Crowley describes researching Walking Sam at a local bookstore whose clerk cautioned him to be wary. She advised me that there really are bad spirits out there on the reservation, and you need to be careful. She said that if you go looking for them, you might just find them. The anthropological roots of Walking Sam play a far more complex role than just functioning as spooky stories. Pete Catch's description of Big Man makes the spirit sound more like a protector of the forest than a god of death. Part Terra, part Totoro. I don't know what that is. As a supernatural entity, he is tied to the land, and the land has a very real impact on the lives of the Lakota. Writing of spending a week at Pine Ridge, Catholic chaplain Jeff Nixa praised the unseen yet vibrant Lakota spirituality all around us. Their sacred earth-honoring ways, inextricably connected with nature and all living creatures, reach far beyond humans and human institutions, he wrote. Although some of the traditional seven sacred rites of the Lakota have fallen out of favor, numerous others, such as the Vision Quest, continue to be practiced along with the Ghost Dance, a popular 19th century hybrid of the traditional circle dance. After Lakota Sioux began practicing the Ghost Dance, members of the U.S. Cavalry attempted to quell the practice in a series of events that culminated in the events at Wounded Knee, which is part of Pine Ridge. And during the 1890 battle at Wounded Knee, U.S. soldiers gunned down hundreds of unarmed members of the Lakota Sioux tribe, primarily women and children. A century later, Wounded Knee was the site of a 1973 protest that led to a months-long standoff between American Indian activists and truth enforcement and law enforcement. Speaking the truth out about the suicides, Dr. Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart, awesome, described the area's tragic historical significance as a burden still carried by those living there today. Historical trauma is cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations, emanating from massive group trauma. Native Americans have for over 500 years endured physical, emotional, social, and spiritual genocide from European and American colonialist policy. For the Lakota, these beliefs aren't just a result of a whimsical belief in the supernatural. They're a way for members of the tribe to feel a connection to the land as well as to their own tragic history. The spirituality of Pine Ridge is as political as it is mystical, and politics have played a more direct role in the fate of Pine Ridge than perhaps anywhere else in North America. It is also important to note that the economic circumstances of those in Ogallala Lakota County, which is the second poorest county in the U.S., a 2015 government survey estimated that 2,000 households in the Ogallala Lakota tribe earn less than 30% of the national median, just $3,500 annually. Wow. 60% of the reservation's 30,000 residents live below the poverty line. The unemployment rate is 80 to 90%. Pine Ridge encompasses a portion of the famous South Dakota Badlands. Only 211 of the reservation's acrid 3,500 square miles are farmable, and irrigation is hard to come by, as is clean water. Though the land produces plenty of agriculture, most of it is leased by the government's Bureau of Indian Affairs to farmers who live off of the reservation. In 2012, this resulted in less than a third of a $90 million Pine Ridge crop actually going to the residents of Pine Ridge. The impact of decades of this redirection of wealth has left the area with no viable economic structure and with devastating poverty levels, with tiny border towns existing solely to sell alcohol to community members, many of whom struggle with alcoholism. Most of the financial aid Pine Ridge receives from the government goes directly to areas outside the reservation. Lakota children are reportedly being placed into foster care at alarmingly high rates, in alleged violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act. The infant mortality rate is 5 times higher than the national average, while rate of sexual assault is 2 times higher than average. Meanwhile, the life expectancy is just 48 years for men and 52 years for women, the lowest rate in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. In April 2015, the White House designated Pine Ridge a promise zone to help expedite the region's economic recovery. But Dominique Allen Fitzen, a high school English teacher and legal advocate on the reservation, believes the root of the mental health issues in Pine Ridge are much uglier: racism. In a blog post on the recent suicides, Fenton cited numerous firsthand accounts of incidents of hostility or overt harassment by area law officials or non-Native Americans in recent months. In one incident in January, students and teachers from Pine Ridge were doused with beer, subjected to racial slurs, and asked to leave for their own protection while attending a hockey game off the reservation. 12-year-old Santana Janice, the youngest of the nine teens who recently took their own lives, was the victim of such racialized harassment shortly before her death. As reported in the Times, on an overnight trip to Rapid City over the new year, a group of girls, including Santana, overheard a white woman call them filthy Indians as they passed through a hotel lobby. "Our kids today just want to die because they're sick of all this oppression," her grandfather, Keith Janice, stated. Additionally, the families of Janice and another teenage girl who committed suicide believe they were each cyberbullied prior to their deaths. "There are a lot of reasons behind the suicides," Poor Bear told the Associated Press. "The bullying in schools, the high unemployment rate, parents need to discipline the children. Add high-profile examples of racism, the daily unreported microaggressions Native kids face, and the structural obstacles that extreme poverty creates, and you start to understand why suicide waves persist." According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide rates among Native Americans between the ages of 15 and 34 are nearly three times higher than the national average. One student told the Times that attempts among teens on the reservation are common. That said, the community response to suicide attempts has been swift and powerful. Last month, Steele declared a state of emergency, and agencies have deployed mental health volunteers to help staff the local hospital. Local students have also organized prayer chains. Yet, as Crowley cautioned, prayer and superstition won't touch the roots of a complex problem. "Belief in bad spirits as a causative mechanism for untimely events among the Lakota is strong," he wrote. Walking Sam may be just one such explanation that resonates among some of the Lakota for teen suicides. It shouldn't distract the reader from the fact that people on the reservations are distraught. Whether Walking Sam represents Bigfoot, an evil spirit, or just a manifestation of the fear that people have about losing their loved ones to what seems an incomprehensible type of event, the teen suicides are real.
Sounds like they got a lot of issues.
Yeah. That's one of the poorest spots in the United States. And, you know, it says a lot about Haiti, though, when it's, you know, outside of Haiti.
Right.
Haiti's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Horrible. I've
heard. Oh, I mean, it sounds pretty dismal and
right.
Desolate.
What's your thoughts on that, though?
Well,
I mean, with the whole spirit thing and the...
As far as that side of it, I think that we do tend to sort of personify a lot of things in our lives.
Yeah.
You know, especially with any kind of extreme situations or emotions or, you know, just things that are hard to cope with and deal with, it's a lot easier to, you know, have a boogeyman to hate on than it is to
right
look at a pile of issues that size and try to figure out how to deal with it.
Or, yeah, find something to blame mm-hmm. for it. I mean, like, there's so many issues. Like, there's the poverty issue. There's the racism issue. There's, you know, this unemployment rate of 80-90%. There's alcoholism. I mean, these reservations are just, I mean, they're horrible places. So you can see why somebody would want to get out of there by one of two ways, right? By growing up and getting out or by killing yourself. You know, I mean, that's pretty much in some ways your only option. Or there's another option possibly of doing something and making it better there. But there's also a lot of issues with that too. Especially with, like, you know, the whole wounded knee thing. I mean, the standoff there in the 1970s, that was something that these people, I mean, they stood up for against getting abused by this, like, tribal council or this, like, strong man on the reservation that pretty much was just using it as his own fiefdom and just taking the money that he was getting from the federal government. And then basically, you know, preying on the people or just plying them with alcohol so they were all just, you know, drunk all the time.
Complacent.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the tall man or the Walking Sam thing, one of the things I heard on the Grayling Report, and Micah talked about this, was like apparently he will go up to your window and look in at night. And I also like the description of him as a Bigfoot wearing like a top hat.
Bigfoot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's what that makes me think of a little bit is that there's these kind of creatures, like especially like in voodoo, there's one of the, I can't remember the name of it. It's like Papa something.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And like he's a skeleton and he wears a top hat. Okay. And then there's also this phenomenon of like the hat man, which is like the shadow person that people will see. And he looks like he's wearing a hat. You know, so like, what's the whole deal with the motif of the hat? Yeah, I mean, that's just a strange thing.
Top hats are just sinister.
I suppose so. Lanky Abraham Lincoln, but then also the connection to Slender Man. Obviously, Walking Sam has been around for a while. You know, he's one of those things. He has a very folkloric element to him. Slender Man, we've talked about on the show before, obviously was made up
right, that's
at the end of the 2000s, right?
Right, it's not an urban legend-y folklore. Yeah. We know who created it.
Right, it was the creepypasta guys that somebody made it, and it became this thread, and people jumped on the bandwagon. But yet, there's kids out there, especially those kids that try to, you know, remember the kids that try to kill the other kid, mm-hmm. that will see, now people see Slender Man.
Right, and so it harkens back to that whole belief is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enough people believe in something, maybe it does start to manifest. And
right. There's the idea of the archetype, like Carl Jung's idea of the archetype, that where we manifest these things or that they have a certain symbolism to us. There's a universal symbolism there that's across cultures. So, like,
That's kind of how I believe about the Bigfoot thing. Just
right.
I mean, you know, people talk about how it's present everywhere on the planet, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's because it's an animal that's present everywhere on the planet. But maybe there's some, you know, deep seated like ancestral memories or something.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the thing that I was going to bring up there, was that there were at one time as humans we shared this world with other primates, other hominids, other humanoids.
Yeah, just a couple hundred thousand years ago.
Right. So they're probably, if Bigfoot is not a real creature, it may be this memory that we have, and that somehow, like the whole concept of the tulpa, like we bring these things into being, like ourselves, through our collective unconscious, through our psyche, through whatever. It's interesting stuff. You know, they talked about, Micah talked about in the Grayling report about, I mentioned the Mad Gasser before, and apparently, like, the Mad Gasser was like this creature that would go up and gas people, and you just smell like this horrible smell, and the people would pass out, apparently. And then there was this other creature called Spring Hill Jack, and Spring Hill Jack apparently was like real tall, and he would like, he's called Spring Hill because like he could jump on his feet, so it looked like he was like on springs jumping around. Like, you jump across buildings and stuff. And people said that they saw these things. And this was in, like, late 19th century Britain and London. Kind of like a Jack the Ripper kind of figure. Right. And again, you know, you've got that black figure, the all in black with the hat. And, you know, like they said, the shadow people. We talked about the djinn before on this show, which was a really interesting one. So, yeah. Interesting stuff. I'm sure Luke would have a witty comment. Like, oh, dude, I'm real tired, man. I've been skating all day.
Saw Spring Heel Jack at the skate park.
Oh, I saw that, dude. All right, Rob. Well, we're going to take a break here. And, guys, we'll be right back with Scott Bennett. We're going to talk about the UBS scandal. We're going to talk about Shell Game. We'll be right back on Conspiranormal. All right, we're back on Conspiranormal, guys. And on the line, we have, via Skype, Mr. Scott Bennett. Now, Scott is what we would call a whistleblower, someone that reveals certain activities that have been covered up maliciously. And that he reveals those malicious activities and brings them into the light, kind of in the long range of somebody like Daniel Ellsberg, who dropped the Pentagon Papers back in the 70s, or more recently, everybody knows, Edward Snowden. So, Scott, welcome to the Conspiranormal.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Adam. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really wanted to get started with, since we kind of have a limited amount of time, about kind of like your background and your background in psychological warfare, working for the Bush administration. I think that's important for everybody to understand where you've been, what you've done.
Yeah. Well, I came out from California after I completed my bachelor's degree in advertising with a double major in film. I had worked at 20th Century Fox, Dark Horse Comics, advertising, things that were very similar to psychological warfare. And I had done that in California and San Francisco and San Jose and Southern California. And I had just got the political itch, the political fever, when I saw the Clinton administration in the 90s. And it was, you know, amplified in the late 90s. And I thought, I want to get involved with political communication, because so much of the Clinton ideology was so perverse and unnatural and wrong and economically foolish. I thought, my God, if we keep following these idiots, our whole country is going to fall apart. And I had a little bit of a cowboy attitude. I was raised in California, and California, for as liberal as some people try and brand it, it really is a cowboy state in a lot of the old West fashion, at least up in the North Pacific Northwest. We were the last frontier of the entire nation. So we have a rugged independence that is very utilitarian, libertarian oriented, and it was a Republican state. So I grew up in a conservative cauldron. So I moved out to Washington, D.C., packing a bag, and wanted to get into political communication, and started pounding the pavement to get connected to conservative organizations, Heritage Foundation, Family Research Council, Concerned Women for America, the Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum. There's like 100 different organizations out there in Washington that I had heard on the radio. And this is 1998. So this is before the internet and stuff really was taken off.
Right. Okay.
And I got out to Washington, you know, sort of hungry and wanting to go into political communication, lobbying. I wasn't quite sure. I just knew, you know, I had a sword in hand and I was ready to travel and go to battle with what I thought was wrong. And I ran into a lot of incompetent people, incompetent conservatives, parasitic conservatives, people that weren't really that smart and engaged. It was almost like, you know, and I know it sounds sort of naive, like, well, that's the way it is in Washington. But when you're going out to a fight, you're looking for fellow fighters. You're looking for, you know, gladiators that are going to come alongside you and say, yeah, we're fighting as hard as we can. Instead, I kind of walked into a bureaucracy of conservative Republicans, and I saw it. I worked at the Republican National Committee for a while. So all of that was a learning experience for the effeminacy, I thought, of a lot of the Republican conservative people. There was no real grit. And I always had it, and I always maintained it, and I always will. But it also had me sharp elbows, and I sort of always thrashed about and fought. But I was very successful. I took a long course from 1998 up in 1998 to 2001. I was doing my master's degree. I was working at the Heritage Foundation. I did a lot of academic work with USAID, CIA, a lot of stuff, you know, I don't talk about. I went over to Europe. I then joined the Bush administration and got my doctorate in political theory and studied a lot of social science research relating to family and marriage. And I was always sort of synthesizing the conservative ethos of family and economics and national security into my communication. Now, one thing that people really need to understand is the difference between the neoconservative class and the conservative class.
Right.
And the difference is, as you know probably well, is that the conservatives, the real conservatives, believe in conserving the bank and capital of nations, the wealth of our history and the tradition and heritage, because there's so much good and energy and purity in that we don't want to lose because it's almost like self-lobotomizing if we do. And the neoconservatives are of the thought, like Francis Fukuyama, which was a professor when I was doing my master's at George Mason, who in fact worked under at the Mason Enterprise Center. I was made director of special projects of a lot of our economic development work.
I believe his book was The End of History. That's what it was called.
That's right. And that was really the catalyst for a lot of the neoconservative theory, just as the Bush administration was standing up. And that was, we know everything there is to know about history. We know everything there is to know about economics, human nature, political organization, because we're at the zenith of civilized life. So now there's nothing else to learn. Let's take what we've got and dominate, conquer, evangelize the rest of the world with a neoconservative ideology. And it tried to compartmentalize religion. It tried to compartmentalize sexuality and marriage and family and make everything and everyone an expression of economic drones or economic, formulaic thinking. And that's really shallow and foolish because it doesn't take into consideration the other organic variables of human life, such as the evolution of personality through time and the intermixing of persons and family and community and myth and lore and spiritual enrichment. So many of the invisible tangibles, they are there that are expressed in nature, for example. You know, nature is an expression of the imagination of God in a lot of, religious analysis. And it's translated into, pantheism and Hinduism in some expressions. But all those things were part of the conservative value of humanity. And the neoconservatives replaced that. So not to go on a rabbit trail, but I really started learning the difference between the neoconservatives. And let's flash forward. In 2001, we had the, quote, September 11th attacks.
Right.
And I was like everyone. I drank the Kool-Aid. I thought it was real. I thought the attacks were real. But I came to discover much later they were false, based on the scientific evidence and the excellent work that's been done by Barbara Honegger and Susan Lindauer and Alan Sprosky and Richard Gage and Jim Fetzer and on and on and on, Judy Wood.
Yeah, we've had Fetzer on the show. Yep.
Yeah. Jim Fetzer is a good friend. And, they sort of reached out to me and brought me into Veterans Truth Network. And that, Stu Webb is a great guy and his whole network has been hacked and shut down. So there are a lot of attacks that are going on with people that are standing up and fighting and making things known and sharing with their fellow citizens. So we are in an information war and we're being shot at. Now, the counteraction to that is overwhelming these shooters in the communication sense, overwhelming them with your mass reinforcements, which are your audience. So everyone that listens to your show that knows you needs to take apart, take a weapon and stand at post and fire communication cannonballs, emails, letters, blog posts, phone calls at these agencies and these congressmen who are associated with surveillance and counterterrorism and FBI oversight and Department of Justice oversight, because those are the lead agencies of the Obama administration that are being used to attack the alternative media type folks, if you will.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Scott, you were in the Bush administration and then at a certain point you joined the Army and fairly like late in life. Usually someone joins the Army when they're like 18, but I believe you were in your 30s by the time you actually joined.
Yeah, I had been in the Civil Air Patrol from 14 to 18, so I got early military training in high school, and then I had a appointment to the Air Force Academy that I didn't take. That was back in 1989, 90.
Okay.
And I just changed from pilotage, and I'd done a lot of military. I wanted to go into the advertising communication realm, so I pursued the private sector life. But then after 2001 – all of this happened, and I had an impulse to apply what I knew in advertising, communication, creative thought. I was very good at influencing people. My master's degree had been on psychological operations and economic development. How do you send messages into people's brains that cause them to want to do economic development and culture development rather than kinetic combat operations, rather than what we see in ISIS and Libya, these wild, savage Indians running around cutting people's heads off and raping women. How do we stop people from wanting to do that and kill the guys who do it and create, you know, peaceful economic development, you know, persons and tribes? So it's very complicated when you deal with the Islamic mind, but it's not impossible if you're smart. And sadly, we have very few smart people in the military and the intelligence agencies that followed what I did with other military guys. But I went into the military as a direct commission officer. I got a direct commission like they give to right. military lawyers and doctors. And I was 38 years old, but I had to go through all the Army training. So it was tough.
I bet.
I felt like Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Yeah. A guy half my age.
Yeah, that's kind of what Colonel Kurtz was that age, I believe, in the movie. Yeah, that's what made me think of. What it made me think of, actually.
Yeah, so I ran the hills and puked my guts out and went through everything I could go through. But it was really wonderful training because they were all Army Special Forces and Rangers that trained me, and it was a very good experience. And it allowed me to learn everything about military tactics and strategy and operational systems and what the bureaucracy of the military is really, and then infuse into it what I was doing at Heritage Foundation, then the Bush administration, and then Booz Allen Hamilton. I had been hired out of Booz Allen Hamilton to join a team of psychological warfare analysts headed by a guy named Colonel Jeff Jones. Colonel Jeff Jones was really the Colonel Kurtz of the psychological warfare community. He was a brilliant man. He had been on the NS, the National Security Council. He had been the father of modern PSYOP of every military operation we'd had in the last 15, 20 years, Haiti, Bosnia, Somalia, you know, everywhere you could imagine. And he had seen me at the Pentagon when I gave a briefing to General Dick Myers and Donald Rumsfeld. And I got a call shortly after that, and I was invited to join his team and et cetera, et cetera. And shortly, about 6 months to 8 months after that, I joined his team, and I joined Booz Allen Hamilton. And at that point, he said, we're going to also put you through military training, get you a direct commission so you learn everything that the military is doing, and you get a top secret clearance and this and that. So I was always serving my country. I wasn't doing any of this for personal gain. I wasn't doing it for professional, you know, monetary enrichment. Everything was a sacrifice. And I did it because I thought my country's at war. We've been attacked. Somebody's got to get into positions of influence to generate psychological warfare that destroys the capabilities of combatants to think and be able to perform kinetic operations against us. And at the same time, persuade our allies to be on our side. So I joined a team of people that were doing that. A lot of them were very, very good. They were colonels and lieutenant colonels and majors in the Army that had just gotten out. And we were all on the same sheet of music. However, everybody in the Bush administration was on the wrong sheet of music.
Yeah.
But we kept shaking our heads and we kept running into, you know, it was like we're told to drive down these roads, but they've littered them with nails. So we're stopped and we're not able to implement what we're trying to do. So we produced an enormous amount of intellectual material, analysis papers on the Islamic threat, the Islamic radical jihadists, the Sunni Wahhabists. But the Bush administration kept stopping us from proceeding.
Why? Why would they do that? It's like, I mean, I think I know why, but for our audience that may not understand that, it's like it seems so counterproductive. Like, aren't these the people we're supposed to be fighting?
Well, there's two explanations. Either they were sorely ignorant and just fools way above their head who didn't know anything about psychology or communications or military operations, and yet they occupy the highest levels in the Bush administration, or they knew full well that if we were unleashed, we would stop the war by killing the enemy inside his head first and foremost within a matter of months, and the wars would have been over, and there would be nothing to do because everybody would be contained. The Islamic jihadis would see, they would be saturated with messages that persuaded them to believe that any operation they engaged in against a Jew or Christian or any U.S. Personnel would guarantee them to go to the torments of the grave, and they would be eliminated from paradise, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So you would have used like passages from the Quran and to demonstrate that. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. That's the key to influencing them is starting it from, you know, injecting the tree from the inside and letting it come out the branches and the fruit. And that is using the legal, scholarly, religious experts, and there are a lot of them that you know laid out a lot of legal theory about how the jihadi Wahhabists were doing things that were really not Islamic, and they were haram, they were forbidden, they were takfir, they were mufsidun, they were things that were damning to the Muslims. Now, these are coming from Muslim scholars and experts that don't necessarily like the United States or Western civilization, but they do love their own people. When they see them doing bad things that are going to harm them, quote, in their afterlife, they step up and try and correct them.
This reminds me of Operation Phoenix from Vietnam, where they would play recordings that were supposedly like Vietnamese ghosts to try to lure the Viet Cong out of the jungle.
Yeah, and that's precisely what would work in the Islamic mind, because they're paranoid of anything occultic, magic, anything that has a flavor of the invisible, you know, realm. There's so many threads that you could pull on that would disassemble them like a cheap blanket, and that's what we did, and that's what we were, you know, brainstorming and putting together, but the Bush administration wouldn't use it. And I'm convinced a lot of it too, you know, you have a lot of things that are now just becoming known that we knew about in 2008, 2009, Man Love Thursday, the pedophilia, the T-boys, all these guys. It's such a corruption in their own culture and being, but it's also the ideal way to make them look like laughing stock, you know, pedophile, you know, deranged individuals. But Bush and his people wouldn't follow the counter homosexual, the counter boy raping narrative that we were developing, for instance, because it ran against their political correct notions.
Right.
That's what was different. The neoconservative Bush administration had a lot of gay people in their ranks. And they didn't want to do anything that could label, that could even draw attention to, you know, man boy love or man love Thursday or, you know, anything of a sexual nature.
Even though it's being broadcast to a different culture.
That's right. Yeah. And I remember people at Heritage Foundation that were close confidants of mine, when I would brief them on some of this stuff, they would say, well, why aren't we using that to communicate to our own people in America and Europe and other nations to build a case against them? And I kept having to say they don't want to do it because it's politically incorrect. And I remember a colonel that worked in Special Operations Command. She was a far left sort of lesbian type, and she threw out a lot of the work that we're doing, refused to implement it. Had we implemented it, you would have a different Middle East, different war that you got today.
Interesting.
But they've just been – they haven't put out the fire. They've been spraying it with a little water to make it smoky, but then they've given it time to breathe and reignite. The problem is every time it reignites, it doesn't turn back into a fire. It turns into a huge inferno, and then it's taken more ground, and that ground is our national reputation. So never before in the history of the United States have we been so blackened and tarred by Libya, by Iraq, now by Syria. And Syria is going to be the real change, the real game changer, because you see Russia, Iran, and China stepping in to contain this cancer of ISIS.
Yeah, I agree. My co-host Luke has a question for you. And yes, Luke is here, everybody.
Hi. Man Love Thursday is actually a real thing. Like they really do that.
Yeah, Thursday is the day when Allah looks away from their sins so they can get a free pass and do anything they want. And anybody that's served, you can ask. And especially any military policeman who's worked at some of the detention centers will confirm that on Thursday it turns into a Sodom and Gomorrah. The guards with each other, the inmates with each other. And remember this, they do not follow a homosexual practice similar to the San Francisco gay parades, where it's their rainbow flag waving identity and this is who we are and we want to get married and we want to be treated like men and women. That's not the Islamic definition of homosexuality.
Right.
That's the U.S. That's the Western civilized. Hey, you know, if you're gay, you can, you know, marry men and you can build a little house and you can live together. That's different than their Man Love Thursday, where they see sexual tension relieving, that relief, as a common practice that Habibis, best friends, you know, girls say best friends forever, you know, on these Twitter things. The Muslim male says Habibi, which is best friend forever. And that's almost like a kissing, you know, fondling boyfriend. But they also have wives, or they're also looking, you know, for women. Now, they don't look at women as beings to completely bond their soul with, to be intimate in exchanging their emotional, intimacies and such with. They see women as simply pods to be fertilized to produce children. And because they produce children, they're blessed and they have a favor with Allah. But if a woman screws around on the man, the woman has to be killed because the man can't get into heaven. That's why you see so many honor killings. It's not about honor at all. It's about the man having a paranoid delusion about not getting into heaven if his woman is sexually, promiscuous or screws around.
We always thought our military buddies were just messing around with us on.
Yeah, we had a common friend. Luke and I have a common friend that was in Afghanistan, and he reported like certain things like that to us too. Like guys would kiss each other, and we didn't think it was as serious. There was a report that actually came out. I heard on another podcast that one of the problems in Afghanistan has been, we've kind of looked the other way while some of these policemen that we've been training, like, actually have sex with little boys.
Yeah.
And it's an accepted cultural practice.
Yeah, it is. You've seen the reports. And I mean, I reported that to Jason Chaffetz, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, Congressman Saxby Chambliss. I reported all that to them. I did a lengthy analytical report on homosexuality and the don't ask, don't tell policy, how that would inflame our radical enemies, because they could now say the U.S. is coming in to homosexualize our country. There's a big difference between our what they say we are versus what they do. What they do, they see is just a normal, you know, it's like drinking a beer, and you say, oh, well, I really shouldn't drink a beer, but I do, or you know, looking at a little pornography or something like that. They look at that as a relief of their daily stresses, and that's the way they look at it. And I wrote a report on that, and I sent it up the food chain and the military and the political systems, and they all ignored it. And it wasn't until recently, when you had the special forces soldier, the officer, by the way, I think, who threw down on the ground that Afghan commander who had chained a boy to his bed as a sex slave, had kidnapped
him. That was the story that I heard. Yeah.
And they've tried to run that guy out of the military and his sergeant, like they did to me. Now, I'm still fighting, of course. I'm still in court, and I'm never going to let this go until the whole thing is reversed. But they've done what they've done to me, they're doing to other men of honor and, family values and such, who stand up and say, no, you will not rape and kidnap a boy and use the American FOB, the American Forward Operating Base, as your sex, room.
Perish the thought.
That's what we're doing. Wonder people join the Taliban, because it never happened under the Taliban. It's only happening now.
Well, I want to talk to you about what happened to you when you got transferred to Florida. These kind of like trumped up charges that they tried to get you on, and they actually managed to put you in jail or federal prison. What exactly were they? Why did they do that to you, first of all? And then what was the charges?
Well, I had been working in the State Department counterterrorism office, and I was the liaison officer to U.S. Special Operations Command up in Washington, D.C. And then I had went and done my Army training. And when I got back, they had said, we want to shift you down into counterterrorism threat finance. implementing psychological warfare into the threat finance dimension. And I, you know, don't talk about anything classified, but it basically was, you're going to be in charge of looking for all money supplies, money donors, money banks, hawalas, every country that contributes money to the Islamic fight at U.S. Central Command. So every Muslim in U.S. Central Command, which is Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, Iran, all of that region, all the money that was going to bad guys who were doing bad things to our soldiers, I was in charge of, or one of the guys in charge of tracking those and stopping those. That's very important to mention, stopping them and arresting them. Whenever I found a little fire, I was to put it out. I was to, set up the targeting and do everything. So I looked at it like whack-a-mole. Okay, I'm whack-a-mole, but I'm an octopus, right? So I'm going to hit multiple ones at one time. Well, they didn't like that because I went in and started my position, and I started tracking things down, and I started challenging a lot of the status quo. I saw a lot of dysfunctionality, a lot of stovepiping, and my boss was Dove Zakheim. Dove Zakheim was the Pentagon comptroller who lost supposedly $2.3 trillion that supposedly was rerouted to Israeli Mossad armaments and other things. And
quote unquote lost $3.2 trillion.
Yeah. Well, the auditors who were tracking that, of course, were all killed in the Pentagon attack. They were in the skiff that was hit, that was not done by a plane. It was done by a missile combination explosion. So our own military were killed because they were tracking this this money trail. And I've talked extensively to Barbara Honegger and others who know everything about the Pentagon attacks.
Yeah.
And you walk away knowing it was an internal plant detonation with a missile or a drone that had exploded. So it wasn't a plane. But so somebody within our own military, our own political establishment, gave the green light to kill our own men in uniform right there. You have the grounds for a major French Revolution in this country, where everybody serving the military should stand up and demand a legal investigation and demand that their politicians who represent them step in and support soldiers who request that. Because when we put our lives on the line, when we swear an oath, when we put on the uniform, it's with the understanding we're not going to get stabbed in the back. We're not going to have a missile fly into a skiff when we're doing work that's going to benefit our fellow citizens. That's how horrendous the scandal was.
Yeah.
And Dove Zakheim was my boss, and he was down at U.S. Central Command handling the money. So I went down and I was briefed about who he was and what he was involved with and his whole character. And I didn't realize, how dirty and all the things that they were doing, and a lot of contractor fraud Anyway, I started making a lot of noise and filing reports, and I won't go into a lot of that specifically because it's still going in the court system, and you got to be careful with what you say. But about 4 months after I had gotten down and was doing my job, I was stopped at the front gate at MacDill driving in, and my car was searched against my will. They accused me of a DUI, which is totally false. It was thrown out. Because there was no evidence, there was no alcohol, and I knew that, and I thought it was a test. I thought I was down there being tested because I had a top secret clearance and I was going to be deployed. But next thing I know, I'm stopped, and I'm sent into the Tampa Police Department. I get out and I go back to base. I'm stopped a second time, ordered out of my car at gunpoint, and kidnapped onto base, where I'm interrogated for the next 10, 12 hours. And again, I think this is all a test, and I'm, this is a big misunderstanding, because I had some guns in my car that were being registered, and they essentially said, well, you're living on base and we don't have your forms and your orders. And I said, well, I'm with Booz Allen Hamilton and I'm a Army Reserve officer. And they said, well, until we get this all figured out, you're going to be removed from base. So they removed me from base. And then within a day, Booz Allen Hamilton fired me because they had removed me from base. And I said, how can you fire me? They've removed me from base for a base housing form that you, Booz Allen Hamilton, helped me facilitate. And I was transferring as an Army officer. So there was a lot of weird, you know, paperwork issues. This isn't you're being accused of talking. You're being accused of stealing. You're being accused of actions against the United States. This is, hey, you've gotten down here and you're living on base and your housing form, we say, hasn't been filled out properly. So we're going to terminate you and yank you off base and suspend your security clearance. That was essentially what they did. And the next thing I know, I'm given a lawyer called David Shalala, who was Donna Shalala's nephew. Donna Shalala was later discovered as working at the Bush administration, or the Clinton Foundation. She was Clinton's Health and Human Services Secretary. She's high level up there. And David Shalala was my lawyer because he was down in Florida. And I think a lot of this was preconceived. And I thought it was all going to be thrown out. I was told by him, well, they're just embarrassed about some things. You know, this will all go away. And the next thing I know, I'm charged with making a false statement on a housing form. And it was 100-1, a felony, making a false statement, as if an FBI agent came in and questioned me and I lied to him. That's the same law that they used against me for filling out my housing form. And wow. I went to court and I kept saying to my lawyers, you know, what's going on? How come I'm here? Where are the military lawyers? I should have military coming in. I've made requests. And I kept being told, don't worry about it. It's going to go away. Don't make noise. You know, this is a political embarrassment because they've just had this major Nadal Hassan or whatever on Texas shoot up a base.
Yeah, Fort Hood. Saying, yeah.
You know, your housing wasn't quite right. And I'm saying, this is really weird, but you know what? I'm going to let it settle out. But that was foolish because I should have fought like a rabid dog, because once they get you in the court, then you're basically in the tar pit, and you don't realize it until the end, when a jury of half retarded people who don't know anything about the military, don't know anything about top secret clearances, and they just know, well, this guy's in a federal court charge and the military are coming in and trying to prosecute him. He must have done something wrong. So they voted me guilty.
Now, so had you been in a military tribunal, they would probably have not found you guilty.
Well, the military tribunal would have never even charged me because there was not a single violation of a military action. That came out like 9 months later. They put me into this federal prison, and the whole time I'm banging on the door saying, get me a military lawyer. You guys have no right to have me in here. I was on a military base. I'm a military officer.
Right.
And 9 months later, I finally got a hearing, and the military lawyer who represented me say, I'm not going to tackle any of that. I'm just going to say, you shouldn't be discharged. And I said, well, wait a minute. This isn't about discharge. This is about why I'm in prison in the first place. I shouldn't even be here. So I kept running into people that were sorely incompetent and stupid, or they were on the take, or they were paranoid of who I was and what I did and what I knew. But I'll tell you this, this is the ironic, you know, miraculous situation. When I went into Florida and they found me guilty, they immediately threw me into prison and they were supposed to send me out to California. However, when I got out to Oklahoma, the bus turned around and I went to Pennsylvania. And when I was at Pennsylvania, I met Brad Birkenfeld, the Swiss banker who had brought 52,000 bank accounts that were used in terrorist financing, money laundering, offshore accounts, all sorts of things.
That was my next question. Do you feel like they put you in, or that you weren't in the same cell, but you were in the same prison? Do you feel that you guys were put together?
Well, it was a divine moment of getting put together. The jury is still out on if we were put there together by white hats. But there were a lot of other people at that prison that were there for political reasons. People that had been persecuted by Chris Christie. And it was very strange. I mean, I was up with lawyers and doctors and stockbrokers, but I was the only military guy who was there for military related stuff.
Why was Birkenfeld there?
Well, Brad Birkenfeld was there because he brought over 52,000 bank accounts from Switzerland, to Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer. And he did that after he had been targeted by the CIA, and Edward Snowden was part of the CIA team that targeted him. You can't make this up, but you track it and you see these pieces were in full play. The American media won't talk about it, but RT and Press TV and some of the alternative channels that I've interviewed with have. They've actually reported it. But Edward Snowden worked with the CIA in Geneva, Switzerland, and Brad Birkenfeld was a UBS whistleblower. He was making a lot of noise because UBS was doing, again, a lot of shady stuff with their money. And CIA had approached Birkenfeld, got him into a social environment, got him drunk, got him in a DUI, and the next day a CIA agent walked into the jail cell, flashed his CIA badge, and got him out. This was told to me by Brad Birkenfeld himself.
Okay.
And Snowden came out and reported the same story to Glenn Greenwald. Now, Birkenfeld had fled the CIA, fled Geneva, Switzerland, and reported this to Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer, the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice, instead of embracing him, they cobbled together a charge against him because he had went into the state. I mean, his whole story is miraculous because he went into the Department of Justice to say, give me a subpoena and I can tell you everything. They said, we do not want your subpoena. Get out. Now, imagine that. Here's a guy coming over with a treasure chest of Swiss bank accounts of every bad guy in the world. And the Department of Justice is not going to subpoena that to say, yes, we want to know it.
Yeah.
They kicked him out. He goes to this SEC, the Security and Exchange Commission. They say no and kick him out. He goes to the IRS. They say no and kick him out. He finally gets to Senator Charles Grassley and Senator Carl Levin. And Senator Barack Obama was on that committee, the Senate Permanent Investigations Committee. And they give him a subpoena, and he goes behind closed doors and he tells his story. And within a matter of months after that, the FBI or the Department of Justice say, you didn't tell us about this client, Alenikoff. We're going to charge you with conspiring to hide taxes. And he said, I came over and told you all of this stuff. Here, it's in the email document list. What are you doing? And they said, no, all that's classified because it was behind closed doors. So we're going to charge you. Take a plea. And he's just like a deer in the headlights that's been hit by a rock. And he doesn't know what is up and what is down and what's right and what's left. He's stunned. And yet they're treating this like a normal everyday thing. They're charging him with material that he gave to them at a Senate hearing. Incidentally, they did the same thing to Joe Nocio, the Quest Communications president, who came forth and said Snowden's revelation about NSA vindicated him because Joe Nocio was Quest Communications president. The NSA had approached him trying to get list of his customers, and he said no, and they threw him in jail.
Wow.
Yeah, none of his material they would allow as his defense because it was classified. So Joe Nocio had to spend time in prison because he couldn't defend himself with the material that would have proven NSA was violating the Constitution. And they were simply threatening him. And because he wouldn't play ball, they dogpiled on him and put him in jail. They did the same thing to Birkenfeld. They did the same thing to me, but I wouldn't play ball. I didn't take a plea deal. I fought in court, and that's what saved me because in fighting, yeah, they can throw me into prison for a while, but when I get out, I'm still in the game. I'm still in the legal fight, and they're on defensive. They're on the run, and it's only a matter of time until my chess pieces get them into a corner, and it's at last, you have no fight. You violated the Constitution. You did something that's never been done in the history of the United States. You threw a military officer in prison for something he did as part of his duty. That's like giving a guy a speeding ticket who's driving a tank in Iraq. You don't have jurisdiction. So that's the fight that will eventually come to pass. But Birkenfeld was in prison. I met him over 6 months. We put all this together. And I said, Brad, you're the golden goose I was looking for. And when we talked and he discovered, you know, all of his material should have come to me, but never was because Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer forbid it.
Held it back.
Forbid any of his intelligence to go to the military. Why? because Lanny Breuer and Eric Holder worked for a law firm called Covington & Burling before they joined the Obama administration. Covington & Burling was the law firm that represented UBS and HSBC. So the law firm that represents these terrorist financing banks told Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer with Hillary Clinton to throw Birkenfeld in prison. And they did. That's the other treason. These people were in government positions and totally betrayed an American citizen. Hillary Clinton is now going to fall for this because of all of her emails that they're now they're finding. And I've been in touch with Judicial Watch and those who were doing the FOIA requests. All of her emails are going to contain things, including Brad Birkenfeld, Union Bank of Switzerland, the WikiLeaks cables that came out that Birkenfeld gave to me, all talked about Hillary Clinton working to get a political solution, get treaty status preferential with the Swiss, and get Chinese Uyghur terrorists released to Switzerland, all in exchange for throwing Birkenfeld under the bus. Whoa. And on top of that, Hillary Clinton got money from Union Bank of Switzerland. Barack Obama got money from Union Bank of Switzerland. Eric Holder got his job back. Lanny Breuer got his job back. Now, when I was reporting all this, I was sending it up to the House Armed Services Committee. Well, who do you think worked on the House Armed Services Committee? The son of my old boss, Dove Zackheim.
Dove Zackheim.
A guy named Roger Zackheim. He worked at the House Armed Services Committee, is getting my reports that are talking about his good old dad, Booz Allen Hamilton terrorist financing, UBS, Swiss banks, and Covington and Burling. And what does this guy do with my reports? He doesn't do the constitutional thing. He doesn't do the American thing. He does the traitor thing, and nothing gets up. And next thing you know, Roger Zackheim gets hired by who? Covington and Burling. So he leaves the House Armed Services Committee and walks across the street. And now he is working with Lanny Breuer and Eric Holder and Michael Chertoff in Covington and Burling, representing Union Bank of Switzerland, HSBC, and all these banks that the Saudis and the Gulf nations are using to channel money to fuel their jihad in Syria, in Libya, and elsewhere.
So let me make sure I have this right. These banks are sending the money to these terrorist organizations are indirectly through the middlemen of these terrorist organizations.
Oh, it's like a, yeah.
Meanwhile, we've got our own senators, our own politicians that have their hands also tied to these very same banks.
Well, that's why Boehner was relieved. That's why Boehner has retired. It's got nothing to do with it. It's Boehner had a Swiss bank account, a UBS account. So did Mike Rogers' wife, I believe. But Boehner is up to his gills in this, and no one's reporting it because I think it's so explosive. But
hello, Scott. Going on.
Dude. You back on?
You there?
Yeah.
You there?
Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me?
Hey, Scott, can you hear us? Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me, Scott? Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me now? He called back, but he can't hear us.
I cannot hear you.
Yeah, he can't hear us.
But it seems very funny. The audio just went out when I mentioned John Boehner being removed because of his connection to Union Bank of Switzerland and having a bank account there. So I'm happy to continue. If you can hear me.
I can hear you. Can you hear us at all?
I cannot hear you. My mic and everything is operational. I didn't touch anything. But you can type in any questions, and I will be happy to respond.
Here, let me
start the call over again.
Yeah, let's disconnect.
Two, one. I would just close saying that we're being hacked. The computer technology system is being attacked by FBI, NSA, CIA, or some sort of hacking division of cyber warfare because they don't want this material to be discussed. It's interesting that this happened the moment I mentioned John Boehner being kicked out of Congress because of his role in the Union Bank of Switzerland terrorist financing connection and accounts. John Boehner goes back to the beginning of this whole saga in 2010. I had sent him a report on the Man Love Thursday, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, homosexual activities in the Middle East. And 1 month after submitting that report to John Boehner and the Pentagon, I was indicted. So the stories that you see with special forces and soldiers being kicked out of the military because they're standing up to the boy raping pedophilia that's going on, that's rampant in the Afghanistan theater, John Boehner and Jason Chaffetz and Saxby Chambliss knew well aware about all this stuff. So that's the trigger that seems to have caused this cyber attack. But I would say it can be rectified by filing an official investigation and request for legal action, because we can't as a republic long endure when our own government is engaged in stifling free speech. And this is a perfect example of it. So my experience in the whole Union Bank of Switzerland, meeting Brad Birkenfeld, discovering the Swiss bank accounts, and then filing the book Shell Game, which you can Google, Shell Game by Scott Bennett. You can also go to the webpage, armypsyop.wix.com/Scott Bennett. But if you Google Shell Game by Scott Bennett, you will see all the whistleblowing reports and all the documentation that went up that affirmed Brad Birkenfeld had Swiss banks that were being used to fund the jihadist terrorists in the Middle East that we now see embroiling our operations and the destructive force in Libya, which is still an open sore given that it's directly connected with the selling of arms to Syria through Turkey. And the Turkish ambassador representative, who is the last person to be with Ambassador Chris Stevens in Libya. A lot of this material is just unfolding. The key parts of my own little small part of this puzzle is I was connected to Edward Snowden, Brad Birkenfeld, and it's what causes Union Bank of Switzerland to be connected to Booz Allen Hamilton and Booz Allen Hamilton to be connected with NSA, CIA. So we look forward to continuing to fight this in court, fight this in the political spheres, and we encourage every patriotic citizen to stand up and challenge and fight and hold up really the Shell Game business card that you can get from my website, hold it up to their member of Congress and say, I know this military officer submitted this report to you and you did nothing. Men and women are dead because of it. I'm holding you to an account. This card, this message, this book can serve as the shield for every American to demand accountability, because blood has been shed. Men and women are dead and crippled because of these bank accounts that have been funding terrorism. And our own government personnel have known all about it since 2012 and consciously done nothing. That's treason. And that's the next thing that needs to be prosecuted in an international court, if not in a U.S. court. So I'll close it there and say thank you very much, Adam, for having me on your show.
Thank you, Scott. I know you can't hear us, but thank you. Okay, guys, we're back on Conspiranormal. We had to adjourn and go back to the old studio.
Yes, we did.
Because we don't know what happened.
Rod's computer took a huge dump.
Just as our guest was mentioning John Boehner's retirement and his involvement with the UBS bank scandal, all of a sudden just everything just went silent.
Everything in my garage stopped working all at the same time.
so that's why we heard just nothingness And then all of a sudden Scott Bennett came back. We could hear him. He couldn't hear us, so we just went ahead and did like a little like conclusion. But pretty interesting information. I would really love to get him back on, but now I'm kind of worried we're going to get hacked.
We'll have to fly him in and have him in studio.
Yeah, man. That was just crazy.
Yeah, but what if there's IEDs in the studio?
There might be. Well, what do you think about that, Luke? Because you were really getting into it, and yeah, we were all getting into it, and then all of a sudden, it was just like, done,
something
you know?
Something really interests me, and I'm sitting here like, oh, what's you going to say next? And then all of a sudden, it's just... Great.
Yeah, and Rob, like, gets him back on, and like his video feed was going insane, was going crazy, and all kinds of stuff, man. So
yeah, multiple issues. Like
that's... We're back in. Yeah, we don't know. We're about to interview Peter Robbins for the next show. But here we are, guys. We don't know. This show is probably going to be out after that show. So it's going to be a little weird in time. But, you know, whatever. But
since his show was so short, why don't you just make like a double whammy?
Yeah, we could do that. It's a possibility. I'm not sure. I kind of just... Well, actually, we did 30 minutes last week of reading an article, so it'll be a nice length. Plus, I'm sure everybody's tired of 2.5-hour shows.
Yeah.
So
I'm sure everyone missed me a lot, man.
Everybody misses you all the time. But guys, we're gonna call it a night for this show. But please listen to us. We're gonna have a special guest on in October. We got plenty more coming up. Hopefully the NSA doesn't take us out again like they did tonight, or CIA or FBI or whatever the hell they
were.
And
don't even say that. Now they're going to get your computer.
Yeah, and we're about to talk about, you know, chronologically here, we're about to talk about Bentwaters and more like whistleblowing and stuff. So hopefully they don't take us out now. So we'll see, guys. This may be the last you ever hear of us. So we might be in Gitmo by the end of the night.
I've got the SPBC after me. So.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back on Conspiranormal! Hopefully.